I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Let me ask you a question. How does your favorite song make you feel? Music affects and changes people's lives. It invokes memories. The first gig you went to, the first record you bought, that song from your school days, or the song you danced to at your wedding, or even your first kiss. It gets you through the worst times and the best of times. Music has always played an important part in my life. First and foremost, I'm a music fan, but I've been lucky enough to have interviewed some of the biggest names in music, combining my career with my passion. Each week, I chat to some of my favourite artists to talk about the tracks of their lives and more. I'm Kylie Olsen, and this is Music and Me.
He pretty much shot the 70s and 80s with his iconic pictures forever capturing some of music's most loved heroes, from John Lennon to the Sex Pistols and Debbie Harry, with his pictures becoming as iconic as the subjects that were in them. Now, the first time I met Bob Gruen was with the Stones in London, along with another great photographer, Gerard Mankiewicz. And when I saw these two in a corner chatting away, I could not believe my luck. Now, keeping in touch with them, I knew that when I was next in New York, which is where Bob was born and bred, I desperately needed to sit down and have a proper chat with him about some of his photos he's taken over the years and the stories behind them. Was I excited to pop along to his studio, which he's had since the 70s, and have a little rummage through some of his work? Hell yeah. So Bob, thank you for inviting me along to your amazing New York studio. It's very cool. You've been here for quite a while because you're a proper New Yorker.
Yeah, I live here all my life.
That's quite rare, isn't it, to find New Yorkers in New York?
Well, there are a lot around, but yes, it is rare. Most people come from somewhere else.
Yeah. And you've actually been in this building for how many years now?
I've been in the building since 1970, 48 years.
So you've probably got a lot of stuff in here that, you know, that you maybe haven't found, that you forgot about, that's from some pretty interesting projects that you've worked on.
Well, we're in the midst of an archiving project now where we're collecting all my stuff, and we do come across some things that I didn't quite remember, but I do remember most of it.
So let's start at the very beginning. When you think back to being a kid and being at home with your parents, thinking about music and you know, what is the one song that does remind you of being at home as a kid?
The first rock and roll song I heard was a song called Black Denim Trousers and Motorcycle Boots, which was a hit here in America a couple of times. I think it came out in 1954. Later Edith Piaf covered it in a French version. And looking back, when I hear it, to me, it's the first kind of rock and roll song I ever heard because of the subject matter and the beat and so on. But listening to it, I don't even know if there are guitars on it. There's a lot of horns. It's kind of an orchestration song. But Black Denim Trousers, Motorcycle Boots, that's the first rock and roll song I remember.
He wore black denim trousers and motorcycle boots and a black leather jacket with an eagle on the back. He had a hopped-up sickle that took off like a gun. That fool was the terror of Highway 101.
I remember talking with my mother when I was 4 years old before there was rock and roll. It was her hobby, and she liked to develop and print her own pictures. And when I was too little to go to sleep early and too big to go to sleep early, but too little to leave running around the house, she took me in the dark and with her. And that's when I first learned developing and printing. And I took to it, I liked it. So when I was 8 years old, they gave me my first camera. Rock and roll came along a couple of years after that. And and I just started taking pictures, family pictures. I was a family photographer. I think that was good training for rock and roll because you have to get five or six dysfunctional people to all look good at the same time. So that's pretty much what I did for the rest of my life. And after high school, my idea of a career, you know, in the 60s was to turn on, tune in, and drop out. And so I dropped out and lived with a rock and roll band, little knowing that I was actually falling into the rest of my life and an actual career. I didn't really want to work. I wanted to hang out with a rock and roll band. But then they got a contract, and the company, the record company, used my pictures and started to hire me for more you know, more bands and more pictures. And then a big break actually was when I met Ike and Tina Turner. I went to a show of theirs and I took some good pictures, and then a couple of days later went back to another show and brought the pictures to show my friends. And as we were leaving, one of my friends saw Ike Turner walking from one dressing room to another and kind of pushed me in front of Ike and said, "Show Ike the pictures." And Ike stopped and said, "What pictures?" And I showed it to him, and he liked the pictures very much. It was that one there.
That one.
Which is actually one picture of Tina. It's not a multiple exposure or Photoshop or anything.
You just had the shutter speed quite low.
Shutter speed for 1 second, and she was dancing in a strobe light. So it's five different images in the one picture. And I took about four or five shots like that. The other ones are useless because the images were all over the frame. Mm. But this one came out kind of perfect. And when I showed it to Ike, he liked it a lot. And actually took a couple of other pictures that night that were good, so he liked those. And pretty soon he met me in New York and introduced me to the publicist. And just things started snowballing. I started working with them a lot. I started traveling with them, making videos for them. There's actually a DVD that's been released of my videos of Ike and Tina, called Ike and Tina Turner on the Road, 1971-72. And if the movie What's Love Got to Do With It shows why they broke up, my film shows why they were together in the first place.
Ah, okay. So, yeah, what were they like?
They were the hardest working couple in show business. It wasn't a traditional marriage in a sense, like, you know, they're a loving couple that's always together. They were both kind of, I mean, I lived in the studio pretty much, and Tina was living at home with the kids. And there were other girls involved too with Ike, and it was a different kind of lifestyle. Not your typical marriage.
So, you mentioned obviously some of the people that you've worked with. You worked with the Sex Pistols as well. How did that all come about?
It's actually an interesting journey how I met them, because it was actually... I met John and Yoko through an interview, and they liked the pictures that I did that night, and they asked me to come back more often, and I started working with them. And they were working with a band called The Elephant's Memory, and they recorded an album, and The Elephants were using my pictures in their album package and for their album cover. So I met their manager, and it turned out that their managers were also managing the New York Dolls. So they suggested I come down and see them, and I loved the Dolls and got to meet them, and we got along really well. And like I say, they became part of my family, practically. We spent a lot of time together. I traveled quite a bit with them. I also made a video of a DVD of the New York Dolls called All Dolled Up. And actually, we made two. One is called All Dolled Up, and the other one is Looking Fine on Television. And it's the only really record of the New York Dolls back then, walking and talking and playing live shows and backstage and traveling. The same kind of thing I did with Argentina, backstage, traveling at home in the studio. Because with the videotape, we used to just record. And like I said, these kind of groups that I got to be comfortable with, I was there all the time. So with the New York Dolls, I was working with them a lot for several years. And towards the end, as they were breaking up, actually, Malcolm McLaren got involved because he made some clothes for them. And, you know, they say Malcolm was the manager of the Dolls. He was the manager for the last couple of weeks while he was trying to get them to advertise his clothes. And I credit Malcolm with saving your life, because at that point, Johnny and Jerry were really deep into a drug habit, and Arthur was an alcoholic, and Malcolm got them into hospitals and saved them and dried them out and got them healthy enough to play a couple of shows wearing his red outfits, the red patent leather series that the Dolls did. But then they broke up. Eventually, Malcolm went back to England, and about a year later, I went to England for the first time, and the only people I knew in England was the editor of the Melody Maker, Roy Coleman, and Ray Coleman, and Malcolm McLaren. So I called Malcolm up, and he found me a place to stay, and he took me to a place called Club Louise in London. It was kind of an underground club, and at the time when I went there, it seemed like the whole beginnings of the English punk scene was in that one room in Club Louise. I met the Sex Pistols, The Clash, Susie and the Banshees, Marco Peroni, and Billy Idol, and Caroline Coon and John Savage. It was just the basic kernel of what became the punk scene in England. And they were all right there in that one place. And Malcolm introduced me to them all, and I was taking pictures of them, and I came back about 6 months later and got more involved, because that first time I was there, the Sex Pistols had just come back from Sweden or something, and Johnny Rotten had something on his throat that he didn't really want to sing. But I went to a rehearsal, and I took some pictures of them rehearsing, and I was actually there the day they signed to EMI, so I have some pictures of that. When I came back, Caroline Coon took me to see The Clash, and I was totally blown away. I saw them at the ICA in London, and they were just phenomenal, the power and the strength of it, and I knew I wanted to see them again. And so when I came back a year later, the record company said they couldn't really help me, but because The Clash didn't really work with the record company. But I asked them, just tell me where they are and I'll go find them. And they were in Edinburgh, and I said, I'll buy a ticket on the sidewalk if I have to. I want to see the band, you know, because I've been in photography as a career, but also because I'm a fan. And with a band, after I'd seen The Clash, I wanted to see them again. So I really was willing to just buy a ticket on the sidewalk and go into the show. I've done that for other bands. As luck would have it, my life tends to work in mysterious ways. When I went to Edinburgh and I was checking into the hotel, Mick Jones and Paul Simonon happened to be at the desk asking the clerk about something, and Mick recognized me from Club Louise. He said, you're that guy from New York, right? And I was like, yeah. And he says, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm coming to see your show. And so he brought me to meet their road manager, who got me passes, and I actually spent the next 3 days with The Clash and getting to know them. And then when they came to New York, shortly after that, or about a year later maybe, I was the only person they knew in New York, and I had a nice car, so we drove around a lot and got to know each other even more. And eventually when they came to tour, I went on two bus trips across America with The Clash. I also went on the Sex Pistols and Tories trip across America. Anarchy for the UK, it's coming sometime. I might be, I give a wrong time, stop a traffic line. Your future dream is a shopping scheme design. You have a pair of boots, don't you? Was it, who gave you the boots from the Sex Pistols? Was it Johnny Rotten or Sid? Sid. Well, because I had a pair of boots, they were engineer boots, American engineer boots, and actually Johnny, one time when I went to England, Johnny Thunders had lost his boots, or someone stole them or something. He asked me to bring him a pair of boots, so we had the same kind of boots. And Sid had seen the boots on Johnny, and then when he saw me with the boots, he wanted the same kind of boots. They're serious, heavy-duty engineer boots with a metal toe. And so I was wearing them when I went on the Sex Pistols tour bus. And at one point, I fell asleep in the front of the bus on the couch there. The boots were on the floor. And when I woke up, Sid was wearing my boots. And what I heard later, Johnny told me he and another guy was sitting there, and Sid took my boots and tried them on while I was sleeping. And he liked them, and then he took his knife out and actually held it to my throat and said to them, like, if I kill him, I can keep the boots. And I didn't know about it because I was sleeping. What I don't like about the story is that Johnny and the other guy didn't do anything about it. They just watched to see what would happen. Anyway, he didn't kill me, obviously. And when I woke up, he was wearing my boots, and he had a pair of paratrooper boots that he said, you can wear my boots if you want, you know. Now, the thing about it was that I had stood on the front of one of my boots one time. I was at a club, and I was trying to get a little bit higher to get a, over somebody's head to get a picture. Mm-hmm. So since there were these steel toes, I kind of stepped on one to get an extra 2 inches higher. But that bent the toe down. And because it was steel and it was inside the boot, I brought it to a couple of bootmakers, but they couldn't really get an angle to bang it back out. It was very, very heavy steel. So it was always a little off, and if I took a step the wrong direction, it would kind of cut into my foot a little. So I didn't really like those boots. But Sid said he wanted to wear them. He was wearing them. The nice part of the story is that in the next day, both Johnny Rotten, Steve Jones, and Paul Cook, all three of them, came up to me separately and said, listen, you know, Sid doesn't run this band. If you want your boots back, don't think, you know, don't be afraid to ask for them. It's not like if you want your boots back that you're going to get thrown off the bus or anything like that. If you want them, just ask for them. They're yours, you know. And I said, well, actually, I'm kind of enjoying Sid's very, very comfortable paratrooper boots. Let him wear mine as long as he wants. I don't really mind because, like I say, they hurt my feet.
Yeah. You know?
I'd rather have his boots. And then actually what happened was on the last day of the tour, we were in San Francisco, and they brought them to a store where they could buy leather jackets. And the store had the exact same kind of engineer boots. So I showed Sid, I said, look, Sid, here's a brand new pair. We'll get your size, and you can break them into your foot. They'll be yours. And he goes, no, I like the way yours are broken. I'm going to keep yours, but I'll buy you a new pair. So I came home from the tour with a brand new pair of boots that were working, that weren't bent for my feet. And I also have Sid's boots. So someday if you see Sid's boots on eBay, you'll know I'm running out of money.
So you still have them?
I still have them.
Where do you keep them? Are they in this? They're hidden. They're not on display.
They're not on display. No, I have them stashed away, but with a picture of Sid wearing them.
Oh, brilliant! That you took,
so
of course.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Were you Were you a fan of their music?
Of the Sex Pistols?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. I mean, I became a fan, and certainly now when you hear their songs, they sound like anthems. Back then, their shows were more like chaos. It wasn't about liking the music or not. The whole show was just chaotic and fun for me. I mean, I enjoyed it. Some people don't like chaos. Mm. I do. I thrive in chaos. I mean, I actually enjoy peace and quiet, but I thrive in chaos. But I do remember the first time Malcolm, I came back to England, I guess, 77, and Malcolm, I stopped by the office, and Malcolm gave me a copy of the record. And I went to a friend of mine's house who had a good stereo. We put the record on, and we started listening to it. And I called Malcolm back, and I said, Malcolm, is this a test pressing? You're going to mix this album before you release it, aren't you? And he goes, no, mate, that's the record. And I was like, really? It's going to sound like this, you know, because it sounded so raw and so noisy.
Hmm.
Now it sounds like anthems. It's perfectly clear. But back then, the first time I listened to it, I was like, you got to be kidding.
Yeah, well, it was, I suppose, the start of that whole movement.
I was listening to things like New York Dolls and Alice Cooper and Kiss, Susie Quattro. But that record just sounded like noise. But like I say, now I hear it places and you know every single word, and it does sound like anthems. They had great songs.
I suppose for you as a photographer, they're kind of a dream to shoot as well, aren't they? Because visually how they look and like you say, the chaos that goes with it, you know you're going to get some good shots.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they're very visual. They knew what they were doing. They were putting on a show, but it was a little difficult because the audience was such chaos and there were things flying through the air, big things, people flying through the air, boots and things and bottles and, you know, it was dangerous to photograph them. So it wasn't exactly a dream. Some of those bands back then, especially when the drugs and the alcohol kick in, the audience got pretty crazy.
Did you ever get hit by anything then?
Not with them. Eventually I did one time at a Ramones show that I didn't even really realize it, what happened. I mean, I was down in front of the show, and by then mosh pit was kind of an established thing. I mean, when I started, even with the Sex Pistols, they didn't really have a mosh pit as such. It was just chaos. But eventually, by the 80s, the mosh pit idea had taken become a thing. And I was at a Ramones show one time, and I remember photographing and looking at the band, and all of a sudden something banged the front of my forehead, and I didn't see, you know, there was nothing around me. I didn't know what had hit me, and I thought somebody had banged into me and bounced off, and I just didn't see it. And after the show, somebody said to me, like, well, man, that was pretty heavy. Somebody kicked you in the back of the head. And I was like, really? I didn't even know it, but somebody apparently kicked me in the back of the head, and my head hit the stage. And I didn't even really realize it. You know, luckily it wasn't hard enough to,
Lucky they didn't have your boots on.
Me out. Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't wearing my boots.
Yeah, exactly. And do you still enjoy taking... I mean, do you still go to a gig and get in the front and enjoy that moment? No.
Hardly ever. I mean, I do with some bands that give me access that I'm friends with, like Green Day. Gives me complete access. There's a band called The Stripes, a new young band that I work with. Because I found it more and more frustrating when bands started restricting access and you can only shoot one song or three songs and then you have to actually leave the venue.
Yeah.
And I didn't always go just to take pictures. I often went because I wanted to see a show.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of taking pictures for, you know, 5 minutes and leaving wasn't what I was about, so I don't really do that. I'd rather go to a show and watch it and not take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, I always have a camera in my pocket. I have a pocket camera and the pocket cameras have gotten very, very sophisticated nowadays. The one I use has a long 10x zoom and it does a RAW file, which is a very large professional file. So you can make really big, good quality prints out of it. It's got a glass lens. It's very sharp and clear.
What one do you use?
I'm using the Lumix camera now.
Yeah.
And it's just a really great little pocket camera. I use Canon camera mostly, but for the pocket camera nowadays, I've been using that one.
Okay, interesting.
So I'm always taking pictures, and whenever I go to a show, I do take some pictures with the pocket camera. I only take the big camera out when I'm working, when I'm being paid, you know, or with Green Day or something like that. I enjoy it like that. But I just practice. It all keeps adding up. I think I'm cracking up. Am I just paranoid?
I remember we were, when we first met, I think it was the first time we met, was at the Rolling Stones Exhibitionism, and I was chatting to you and Gerard Mankiewicz.
Oh,
and I think I said to you both about, you know, why is it, do you think, you know, you're, how it kind of differs now to back when you first started, and you both said access.
Mm.
And that's the thing, and I think that's kind of what you're alluding to now, that
you
don't get as much access.
In the 80s when... rock and roll became very corporate with MTV and corporations realizing there was a lot of money in rock and roll and started trying to take it over and control it. It really started changing, and they, in a misguided reaction to merchandising, they started restricting photography, thinking that if they restricted available photographs, they could restrict available bootleg merchandise. It doesn't really work that way.
Yeah.
No bootlegger has ever bought a picture from me or anybody.
Yeah.
They usually get a free one from the record company. but it just made taking pictures much more difficult and not nearly as much fun. And nowadays, I mean, more and more actually after 2000, as the digital world started growing and becoming such much better quality and so much more available, you know, that your phone now takes really excellent pictures. So you go to a concert and the first song... half the people in the concert are taking their own pictures.
Yeah.
And with two or three touches on the screen, they post them instantly around the world. So before the first song is over, those pictures are all over the world. So that kind of access and news cycle is very hard to compete with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to take pictures and go home and develop the pictures and make prints the next day and send them to a magazine. And within two or three or four weeks, they get published.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's literally... 1 or 2 minutes and they're published around the world.
I've started taking pictures at gigs sometimes as well now, and I'm in the pit for like the first three songs.
Mm.
And I never realized how stressful it is.
Mm.
And then that got me thinking about you guys when you all first started. You didn't have digital cameras, so you couldn't just shoot a million pictures.
No.
You had to really think. Exactly. It was expensive.
And pay for every frame and in money and in time, because every 30 pictures, every 35 pictures, you'd have to change the roll.
Yeah.
And each roll costs money, and the developing of each roll costs money. So you really didn't just shoot wildly.
Mm.
You had to make every picture count, and you had to focus it, and you had to figure out what the setting was, you know, with the f-stops and the speed, which are combined to let a certain amount of light in. All of that is totally computerized now. And the number of pictures you can take is practically unlimited. Since you can take, you know, 1,000 pictures, go home and download them and use that same card over again and take another 1,000 the next day without paying anything, you know. So it's changed quite a bit, you know, the idea of just snapping away. Like, you did have to think of what you were doing and not waste film. And you couldn't shoot as fast. You really had to focus it. You had to think about how much light there was, change the lighting settings, things like that.
Well, do you think most people shoot automatic now then?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, see, I wasn't shooting automatic. That's why I was finding it stressful, because I was like, oh, God, I got to quick, and then you've missed your shot.
Well, yes and no. I mean, with a show, the lighting is changing so fast.
Yeah.
And often, if somebody is lit with a spotlight and it's dark behind them, if you shoot automatically, it won't adjust for how bright the person is.
Right, okay, yeah.
And so the person will be completely washed out because it'll be exposing for the majority of the frame, which is all black, and a bright person in the spotlight gets too bright.
Yeah, and then they get bleached
so,
out.
I mean, I tend to shoot with a semi-automatic setting.
Okay.
It's called program setting, where it's pretty automatic, but you can make it a little lighter and darker. You can adjust things within that automatic setting, so it automatically does things a little differently.
Tricks of the trade. Okay, yes. I'm learning.
Yes, yeah. You put it on the P setting, and then you can turn the brightness up and down.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Thanks for that.
And a big help nowadays is that as soon as you take the picture, you can see it.
Yeah,
in the screen on the back of the camera. You know whether or not it came out.
Yeah.
You can blow it up and see whether or not somebody's eyes are closed.
Yeah.
Back in the old days, you didn't know if you even got a picture until you went home and developed it. You might have had everything set wrong. Or, I mean, just one button set wrong would be everything. And you come home with a blank roll of film, or sometimes with the flash setting, the flash wouldn't synchronize on every speed. So if you had the speed one or two clicks off, you'd only get a half a frame or a third of a frame. That could be very frustrating.
Okay, so
you're being paid for the job.
Yeah, that's stressful, isn't it?
Yes,
so
it
that,
is.
So that, I suppose we've seen all
it's,
your amazing
it's so
pictures.
Stressful that, for instance, something really important like the Rolling Stones, where you only get two or three songs, and you have to get a lot of pictures because there's a lot of outlets and there's a lot going on, and you want pictures of each guy separately and together, and they're running all over the place, and you're trying your best to focus it and shoot it and get the exposure right and, you know, do all of that, and you only have about 6 or 7 minutes, so that when I would come off and people say, what songs were they playing?
Oh, you have no
and
idea.
And I had no idea, and I would say, you know, I was singing along and I have no idea what songs they were, because you're just not thinking of that. You're thinking numbers, you're thinking focus.
Yeah.
And literally I could be singing along and not have any memory 5 minutes later what song they were playing.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So we've seen all your amazing pictures, and you mentioned the ones that, you know, that stressful thing when you come home and you're like, oh my God, there's nothing here. When's that happened to you? And who with?
Oh, well, the most memorable was when Bob Dylan was doing the Rolling Thunder tours and they weren't allowing any photography. And I actually got into several shows. I would hide my camera in my boots and put the film in the hood of my jacket. And actually, I put the film on my arm and the lens in the hood of my jacket. I snuck my cameras in and waited till near the end. And then I would pop up and start shooting some pictures. And there was one time I was in Atlanta. And I was actually right near where Jimmy Carter, who became president, he was the governor back then. And he was sitting there with a couple of people. So Dylan was kind of looking towards that direction, and he was looking right towards me. I was right behind the governor in that line, and I was shooting away and kept shooting. And after a while, you kind of realize, like, you should have run out of film. Like, it seems like more than 35 pictures, and I'm still shooting, and it's still going, and you realize that you forgot to change the film. And then I had all of these perfect pictures of Bob Dylan, head to waist, looking right in my direction, like cover, poster, beautiful pictures, and there was no film in the camera. That was frustrating.
That's kind of karma, though, for sneaking in.
That's the one I remember, you know? Well, yeah, because I was sneaking in, maybe that came back. But although I did end up, after 7 shows, I did a lot of covers and posters from that tour.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he let you into the gigs and no.
He didn't let me in. In fact, I met him a couple months later on the sidewalk, and he was furious. He wanted to beat me up. It was the only time I've actually spoken about Dylan. He told me he wanted to beat me up.
You're joking. How did he know?
Meeting God and finding out he wanted to kill you. You know, it's kind of weird.
How did he know that you'd snuck in then?
He saw my name, the photo credit.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, it was kind of a weird thing because I'm a big, big fan. I mean, that's why I snuck in, because I felt it was a news story. I felt it was important. And I didn't think it was right that he could completely ban photography. Mm. And I mean, in years later, seeing it from his point of view, I always felt kind of bad that I snuck in. Because it's the only time I've ever done that. I've always respected people's privacy, but I didn't feel it was private. I felt it was very public, since there was, you know, 20,000 people in the arena, and I just felt, and I wasn't out to expose him or embarrass him. I was out to record the event, and I tried my best to get good pictures, which is why they were on the cover of magazines, because they were good pictures. But he had been trying to control it. He was very angry that I was the only one who managed to sneak in and publish so many pictures. So he saw my name in the magazines. And then I happened to be in Berlin because he was playing there, actually. I was at a Rolling Stones concert, and I ran into the publicist, and I said I was going to Europe. And he said, oh, I'm going with Bob. He's playing in Berlin next week. And I said, really? If I come to Berlin, can I get a pass? And he said, oh, okay, I'll hook you up. So I get to Berlin, and I got in a cab to go to the venue to meet the publicist. And as I was driving, I saw a bodyguard. The first thing I recognized was the bodyguard that I had just been with a month earlier. He was working for the Bay City Rollers at that point, and we had spent a lot of nights hanging out together. And I saw him walking across the street, and then I realized that this scruffy little guy next to him was Bob Dylan. And there was another guy with him, too. And I was like, oh, my God, this is Bob Dylan. And I just, as I say, I'm a fan. I just stopped the cab and jumped out of the cab and came down the block after him. I had no idea what I was going to say to Bob Dylan. I was just excited, you know, like, there's Bob Dylan, wow. And I came down the block, and my friend Patty Callahan turned around, and he saw me. He said, oh, Bob, how are you doing? I said, I'm fine. And I looked at Bob Dylan, and I didn't know what to say. And he was looking at me like, who the hell are you, you know? And I wasn't, it was, like I say, it was in Berlin, but I was speaking English to Patty, so obviously I wasn't some German fan. So Dylan started walking away, and Patty said, oh, I got to go, I'm working. Are you coming to the show? I said, yeah, I'll see you tonight. So then they took about a few steps, and he must have either said to Bob Dylan, you know, do you know Bob, or Dylan asked, who was that? And when he heard my name, he swung around. He says, I know you. I've seen your name next to the pictures. And he had a cane in his hand, a silver top cane. And he started waving it at me. He says, I always said when I met you, I was going to beat you up. And I'm like, looking at Patty, like, I'm looking at Dylan's bodyguard saying, hey, Patty, you're my friend, right? You're going to protect me. I know. You don't have to protect, you know, help. You know. And I kind of talked him down, and it was kind of funny. Like I said, I've always tried to take good pictures of you, you know. And he said, what about that picture with Patti Smith? And I didn't take that one. I knew which picture he was referring to, and a friend of mine had taken it. I said, I didn't do that one, you know. And he just kind of mumbled a bit and, you know, growled and left. And I was kind of shaken because, like I say, it was like meeting God and finding out that he wanted to kill you.
Was that the last time you spoke to him?
It's the only time I ever spoke to him. he's not a very friendly guy, from what I understand.
So what was the Dylan song that got you into Dylan?
Oh, all of them. I remember a friend of mine brought the album, the first album, and I remember where I was in my living room when my friend said, you got to hear this guy, he's really amazing, and he put the record on. And it started playing, and I started laughing. I literally fell on the floor laughing. And I said, this guy's not a singer. What is this? You know? Yeah. And he goes, oh, it's Bob Dylan. He's really good. Listen to the words. And I started listening to the words and started listening to how he was saying the words. And it wasn't your traditional kind of, you know, Elvis Presley singing, but it was very meaningful. To the point that when he made the song "It's All Right, Mom, Only Bleeding," I played that for my mother to explain to her how I felt. And I don't think she got it, but I knew that that's how I felt. And there's many Bob Dylan songs that are kind of like a, almost like a Bible to me. I learned a lot of spirituality from Bob Dylan songs.
Pointed threats they bluff with scorn, suicide remarks are torn from the fool's gold mouthpiece, the hollow horn plays wasted words, proves to warn that he not busy being born is busy dying.
The Beatle man that you worked with as well, John Lennon, of course. I mean, when did you first start working with him? What year was that?
Well, they came to New York in 1971, and I first met them. I think they came in the end of the summer, and everybody heard they were in town, and there was John and Yoko sightings all over, and it turned out they actually got an apartment right around the corner here, half a block away on Bank Street. And people in the neighborhood knew it, but you didn't go and ring his bell and try to meet him or something, you know. But then I went to the Apollo Theater. There was a benefit for the families of the prisoners injured in the Attica prison riot. And John, and I was expecting to see Aretha Franklin there. And as I walked in, I heard the announcer say, John Lennon, Yoko Ono. And I felt like I was hit by lightning. Like, oh my God, I'm in the same room as John and Yoko. Because like everybody, I'd been a Beatle fan. Like many people, I was more of a Stones fan. You know, they say silver, gold, Stones or Beatles. I'm more of a Stones fan.
Me too.
They would just had more of an edge to them. You know, all the girls like the Beatles, so we like the Stones, you know. You know, when I was in college, when the Beatles first came out, it was all John, Paul, George, and Ringo, and all the guys said, now, how about me, you know? But after the Beatles, when John and Yoko started doing things, and they were doing things for peace, and they were doing outrageous things for peace, sending acorns to everybody in the world, instead of hiding on their honeymoon or trying to hide, when they realized that there was nowhere they could hide, they made their honeymoon public and invited everybody in to take a picture of them in bed, in their honeymoon bed, so long as the word peace was in the background, so that every newspaper in the world carried the word peace. Those kind of things really impressed me. And I was a big fan of John and Yoko, much more than I would have been of the Beatles or anybody, actually. So when I first saw John and Yoko, it was like, oh my God, I'm in the same room with these, you know, fantastic people. And then backstage was the first time I spoke to him. In just a very brief way, they were waiting for their car, and a number of people were there. In those days, they had a little Instamatic, a little square camera with a cartridge, and you put a little flash cube in it. And people were taking the same kind of things we would call selfies nowadays. People, you know, with pictures of each other with John and Yoko. And I took a couple of pictures. And at one point, John sort of said to everybody standing around, like, people are always taking pictures of us like this, and we never get to see them. What happens to these pictures? And I said, well, I live around the corner from you. I'll show you my pictures. And he said, oh, you live around the corner? Well, slip them under the door. And I didn't quite slip them under the door. I went by a couple of days later, and I rang the bell. And Jerry Rubin answered the door, which surprised the hell out of me. I didn't know he was hanging out with them. And he said, are they expecting you? I said, no, I'm just here to give this to them. And I left it for them. And later, after we became friends, Yoko said to me that that kind of impressed them, because I was the only person who came by who didn't ask for something. That I was the only person who just gave something and left. And because also they liked my pictures, you know, that I left. And they were like, who was that guy? And then about 4 months later, I was involved. I was included in the first book of Rock and Roll Photography. And the editor of the book liked me and said he was doing an interview with John and Yoko the following week, and would I come with him to take some pictures? And so I did. And I took some pictures that night. They were working with the Elephants Memory Band. And I went to the studio with them, because the story we were working on was actually not about John and Yoko. It was about the Elephants Memory. So I asked them if I could come with them to the studio to take pictures of them with the band. And they said yes, if I waited around the end of the night. And I did. And I took some pictures. And then... it was actually a couple of weeks later they got in touch with me to see the pictures, and they liked them a lot. And because I ran into the drummer, and he said they wanted to see my pictures, and that was the first time he brought me to their house, and that was the first time we really just sat around an afternoon and talked. And they liked those pictures, and they liked that. I showed them other pictures that I'd taken, and they liked that. And at the end of the day, Yoko asked me to come to the studio more often and said that they wanted to work with me and they wanted to know me.
So what was he like to shoot? I mean, was he quite involved on how he wanted it to look, or did he just leave you to it?
Well, he was very comfortable. By the time I met him, he'd already been a Beatle and, you know, was the most famous person in the world for a while. Yeah. So he was very comfortable having his picture taken. They liked to have their life documented. It was, you know, kind of normal for them. So they weren't self-conscious at all, because the deal we made that very first day when Yoko invited me to come more often was that they weren't going to actually pay me themselves. I wasn't being hired on a daily basis. But if I would come, you know, when I had time, and take pictures and then show them the pictures and only use the pictures they liked, then I would be able to sell them, and I would have pictures that no one else had, and I would have access to them to be able to sell these pictures, and I could make money that way. And that's always the basis that I've worked with them on. I mean, over the years, occasionally they pay for an album cover picture or, you know, some publicity or something they use. But mostly I've worked selling, you know, pictures, okay, you know, not charging them. Some photographers don't want to, you know, have to show their pictures to the artist and have to discuss it. I prefer to show my pictures to the artist because I would like
to
use.
Happy, don't you?
I want them to be happy. I want them to hire me again. Yeah. Rock and roll photography is a very low budget occupation, and you can't take pictures just once and expect to, you know, pay your rent. And so, with people like that, I would want to establish a relationship where they would trust me and call me more often, and I could, you know, take pictures more often and have more pictures to sell to pay my rent.
Yeah.
So I prefer to not embarrass people. I would feel, you know, I have empathy for people. So I wouldn't want somebody putting out a picture where I look bad.
Yeah.
And I understand that other people wouldn't like that either. So whenever I can, I prefer to show the picture to somebody and say, is this the picture you want me to use? Because if it's not, I won't use it.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather find one they like, and then they'll hire me again, and they'll let
exactly.
me in. And,
so at that time, that was when, am I right in saying that was when John was fighting the US government,
yeah.
wasn't it? So did he talk much about that?
Well, it was a constant, we didn't talk about it in that sense. You know, when you're friends with somebody, you don't do interviews, you know.
Yeah.
Like people ask me sometimes, did he talk about the Beatles a lot? And he didn't talk about it a lot, except on occasion. I mean, I remember one time. Often he was very proud of being part of the Beatles, and very proud. But no, we didn't really talk about the deportation case a lot, but we did know it was always hanging over him. And we would hear clicks on the phone, and sometimes they were thinking that their phone was tapped. And, you know, people would say, oh, you're just being paranoid. But, you know, there was an expression back then that just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you're not being followed. And there was a couple of nights when I was followed. Which I didn't really connect at the time, because who would follow me? Like, why would somebody follow me? Like, I left the studio with John and Yoko at 3 o'clock in the morning one night, and to come to this neighborhood from there, you have to go down 44th Street, turn left up 8th Avenue, left again over to 9th Avenue, left again down to 14th Street, turn right, turn left, all the way down to this block, and turn right. And there was a car that I noticed them. I mean, there's a car following me when I left. It wasn't a big deal. But when they made the third turn onto 9th Avenue, I noticed that this car is, like, right behind me. And I was expecting they would turn somewhere else, but all the way down to 14th Street. So when we turned on 14th Street, I noticed the guy is still there. And when we turned down Washington, he's still there. And, like, now in this neighborhood, it's not really normal for somebody at 4 in the morning to be going to the exact same place, making all the same turns. So when we got to Bethune Street, I pulled around the corner kind of quickly and parked the car and jumped out of the car. And the other car came around the corner, and there was two guys, and I swear they looked like G-men, like, you know, with an overcoat and a fedora pulled down, kind of glancing up. And they looked at me, and I looked at them, and they sped away. Several years later, we learned that the FBI was following John and Yoko and people around them, and very likely I was followed.
Did you tell John and Yoko that you thought someone was following
you? No, I didn't think somebody was following me. I thought it was just a mysterious, odd occurrence. I didn't think somebody would. Why would somebody follow me?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
exactly.
I just thought it was just really, it was just kind of a weird thing that happened one night.
Yeah.
You know, and we didn't connect it until later when his lawyers found out that the FBI actually had been following him.
So is there anyone left that you'd like to shoot that you haven't?
Not really. I've covered most of my heroes. I mean, I wish I had met Otis Redding, but I started too late for that. Yeah. I met Jimi Hendrix once, and he said, I showed him this Tina Turner picture.
Yeah.
But the first day I made a big print of that. I came out of the subway in Sheridan Square, and I saw Jimi Hendrix walking across the street. And I kind of followed down the block because it was in my direction. And he went into the Pink Teacup, as a soul food restaurant used to be on Bleecker Street. And I hemmed and hawed on the sidewalk whether or not I should go in. And you don't want to bother somebody, but it was Jimi Hendrix, you know. And I just wanted to show him my picture. So after a couple of minutes, I said, what the hell? And I took it out of the envelope and I went in and I said, I just wanted to show you this picture I took. And he looked at it and he said, that's a really good picture. And I said, well, I'd like to take pictures of you. And he said, okay, we'll meet again.
So, are you experienced? Have you ever been experienced? Well, I have.
So if someone's starting out as a photographer today, do you think there's actually a career there for them?
I don't know what kind of advice I give people because I kind of fell into it. It wasn't a career when I did it. I never really looked at it as a career goal. I looked at it kind of the other way around, as something to do instead of working. But it turned out to be very hard work.
Yeah.
You know, I always enjoy taking pictures, but when you're on deadline and when you have to... Because I took one course in photography, but I learned something very important there at the FIT Fashion Institute here. I took a night course once because... As I started getting more and more involved in photography, I never had any formal lesson. And I thought, well, maybe there's something I don't know, you know, besides how to develop and print. So I took a class just to learn some facts.
Yeah.
And what I learned, one of the most important things I learned, was the difference between being an amateur and taking pictures that you like, you know, taking pictures of things you want to see and, you know, when you want to see them, to being professional, which is taking pictures that somebody else wants to see when they want you to do it. And that's a big difference, is to show up and, you know, fulfill someone else's vision on a deadline. That's a big difference. That's the difference between amateur and professional.
Okay.
Amateurs do what they want. Professionals do what the client wants.
Yeah.
And that's a big, big difference.
Yeah.
To try to figure out what they want when a lot of people, it's hard to describe a visual that you haven't made yet.
You know? Yeah.
Now, even people who can make a sketch, it's still not the actual thing with the feeling, with the people. So it gets much more difficult when it's professional.
And I think as well, like for the rock photography or music photography in general, is like looking at that Tina Turner. I mean, that's not a conventional picture that was taken in those days. And so I suppose you had this whole... It's this empty canvas in a sense that you could go out and just kind of reinvent the whole photography that was happening because it was just a standard boring headshot.
Now there's so much that people see and there's so much history that they know the entire history of photography.
Yeah.
You know, it's all online, everything you've ever heard or seen. So it's all derivative nowadays. There's almost nothing that hasn't been done. It's very hard to find something new. You know, but back in the early, you know, in the 60s and 70s when it was being invented, everything was new. So I worked with people like Tina Turner or Alice Cooper or, you know, all the people that back then. It was a new thing. So it wasn't until in the 80s when you heard a band, you said, well, this band is kind of like AC/DC if Alice Cooper was the singer. Well, that band might be like that, but Alice Cooper wasn't like anybody. You couldn't compare him to anybody. You couldn't compare Tina Turner to anybody previous.
Because there wasn't anybody.
Because there wasn't anybody,
you
know. So I was lucky enough to come up with the originals. And now, for me, it's really derivative. It is like this band is like AC/DC with Alice, and I've seen both of them originally. So I don't really need to see somebody who's like them, you know.
You're so lucky to have been part of that scene.
Well,
I mean...
You know, I mean, I feel that there must be a scene now. It's a different scene. But when I was in my 20s, we went out and we found fun.
Yeah.
And we didn't say, I wish I was born in the 40s. I really miss Benny Goodman, you know. And now it's not happening on the Lower East Side like it was in the 70s. But it is happening in Brooklyn. And anybody who's in their 20s is out in Brooklyn. And they're having fun every night. And there must be scenes going on out there that you won't know about for 20 years until people look back nostalgically and say, oh, I wish I was born in the 20 teens because that scene in Brooklyn was so cool. when we went to CBGB's, it was a deserted bar with, you know, that nobody ever heard of. It wasn't the coolest place in town. It was the coolest place in town because cool people went there to get away from everybody else. And it wasn't even cool people. I mean, Patti Smith talks about it all the time. Everybody in CBGB's back in the day was the dropouts, the geeks, the nerds, the people who didn't get along in high school, the people who were not on the football team. They were not the homecoming queen. They were the rejects.
You that's know. Musicians in general, though, isn't
that's
it, I think?
That's musicians in general, exactly. Yeah. So now, somehow, everybody in CBGB's turned into somebody. I mean, even Legs McNeil. I mean, Legs is a very respected guy nowadays. Ever since he quit drinking, he turned into a respectable person.
Yeah.
Back then, when he was drinking, he might pass out in the corner of CBGB's and they would lock up without even knowing he was there, you know? He was incoherent most nights.
Yeah.
As most of us were.
Mm.
That's what we did. That's why we went there. You know, it was always kind of funny. As CBGB started to get a reputation in the 80s, you'd see bands from Europe or from Japan would come to New York and they'd hire a limo to arrive at CBGB. Mm. You see these kids getting out of a limo in front of a CB's and they'd look at it and go, this is it? This little dump of a bar with, the, you know, I mean... For a long time, in the early years, Hilly had these two big dogs that he would lock into the place at night as guard dogs to keep people out. And they would crap all over the place, and he never really cleaned it up.
So
the place didn't just stink from sweat and beer. It was from the dogs. And, you know, it was not a nice place. And these kids would come out of the limo going, oh, I'm in CBGB's. And they'd get the shock of their lives when they realized what a dump it was. You know, the ceiling was dripping, and you didn't know what was dripping because it was these pipes from the flop house upstairs. You know?
I've seen pictures of the toilets, which always freaks me out.
Yeah, well, we didn't really use the toilets much. I mean, the people who went often, we'd use the alley in the back was cleaner. I mean, you didn't know what was in the toilet, man.
Oh, my God.
It was kind of funny that the toilets became famous in a sense, and when they had a retrospective, they had a show about the fashions of CBGB's at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is quite a fancy place. And in the entrance way to the exhibit, they had recreated the CBGB toilet. And seeing that, it's like such a distortion of what went on because we didn't go to CBGB's to go to the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't the attraction. It wasn't the reason we were there.
Wow.
You know, the music was. The people were. I mean, a nice thing about CBGB's was that when Hilly expanded the place, he moved, there was a kitchen and the bathrooms, and he took them out and moved the bathroom downstairs. And the dressing rooms were behind the stage, but the stairs to the bathroom was behind that. So to get to the bathroom, you had to walk past the dressing rooms.
Okay.
So there was never a backstage pass. You were never excluded. There was never a us and them. There was never a separation from the musicians and the audience.
Okay.
And so everybody had complete access to everything. And I think that was one of the things that made it more democratic, that, you know, there was no, you can't come here, you know, because everybody had to be able to get to the bathroom. So there was no, you know, it was like the door, the bathrooms, I mean, the dressing rooms didn't even really have a door. They had a curtain. So you could kind of pull the curtain if you wanted some privacy, but it wasn't like a separate area that nobody was allowed in.
Well, that's
you know,
nice.
And I think that made it much more... neighborhood-like, you know, much more friendly. But most of the people who were there are musicians anyway.
Mm.
You know, if Blondie was on stage, the audience was the New York Dolls, Patti Smith, Talking Heads, and all the other bands.
Because they were all friends.
The next week when Talking Heads were on stage, Blondie was in the audience, you know. And that kind of made everybody compete a bit because we all knew each other. And when you got on stage, you couldn't wear the same outfit you were wearing last night when you were watching Patti Smith or something, you know? You had to wear something new and look exciting. So it really drove people to impress each other.
Yeah.
And you wrote a new song or you got a new outfit or, you know, something like that just to show your friends something they hadn't seen, you know?
I love that Debbie Harry picture that you have of her coming out of the car that's tipped over.
Oh, yeah,
what happened? Did you just happen to stumble across that car or did you place
in
it?
In a sense, yes. The car had actually been there for several days. I don't think today it would last that long, but there was some horrific accident. And I used to ride around New York on a bicycle, so I had seen that car several times. And I went to visit Blondie recording a demo. In a studio, it was on top of the RCA building, on top of the Radio City Music Hall. Upstairs, they had some studios, and they were using that studio. And when we came out, the car was still there upside down on 6th Avenue. And I think Chris said something like, let's take some pictures by the car.
Okay.
And I said, sure, you know. And Chris stuck his guitar in the trunk, so it looked like, you know, it was falling out, so it looked like their accident. And Debbie, being creative, instead of just standing there, she got in, got down on her hands and knees and crawled in and came crawling out as if it was her accident.
Hmm.
So we kind of made up the whole thing on the spur of the moment. And I've always felt a little bad, because I don't know what happened to the people who were really in the car when it flipped over. But we used the wreck of it, and I sent the picture out to a number of magazines when we first took it, and most of them went along with the joke, and Cream Magazine made some very funny caption, and some of the people said, well, what's the story behind this? And I said, well, I made up the picture, you make up the story. And a German magazine got very upset because they wanted to know the facts. And I said, there are no facts. We just made this up. You make up something. And they were like, no, what was the story? And they were very German. Very German about it. They wanted the facts. And I wouldn't tell them, you know. I said, come on, be creative. We were, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's how that just came up, spur of the moment.
Led Zeppelin, of course. Yeah, you worked for them. You took that picture of them outside the Starship.
The airplane, yeah.
Did you get to go
yeah,
on the plane?
I went on the plane that day. It's a very nice plane. It was actually called Starship One Enterprise, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was, and they didn't own it; they rented it.
Yeah.
If you rented it for a month, they painted your name on it. Mm-hmm. And I was on that plane with Elton John as well when his name was painted on it. The Rolling Stones had it for a month. Alice Cooper had it for a while. It was a really nice plane, mm-hmm. a 727. It had two bedrooms in the back. One of the bedrooms had an electric fireplace. It looked like it was a fire, which you don't really want
don't really
in a
need
plane.
On a plane.
You know? But it was two comfortable bedrooms in the back. There was some normal kind of first class seats, a couple of rows of them in the front, and then a big area in the middle that was like a lounge with a long brass bar that had a piano and organ, electric piano organ built into it, and like lounge seats and you know around that part of the plane. And the one time when I went with Led Zeppelin, when we got to the airport, I don't remember if it was Robert or Lisa Robinson said, let's take a picture with the plane.
Mm.
And they walked over by the wing and we took some pictures. What I like about that picture actually is that the plane is so big it doesn't fit in the picture.
Mm.
And it just looks like this ginormous plane behind them. I have another picture with Elton John where the plane is more in the distance in the background and you can see the whole plane. It doesn't
it's
look nearly
big.
As big. You know, it just looks like a nice plane in the background. But this one, it's like fills the whole picture.
Yeah, it does.
And they got no shirts on and they own their own airplane. You know, it's like the excess of the 70s. Yeah. It's all summed up in that one picture. But when I went with Elton John, it was kind of fun because they brought me along because he was doing a show in Boston. And when they had a plane, they would base themselves in one place, like in New York, and then fly within an hour or two. So after the show, you come back to New York. So you had the same hotel room for a month, and you just went out to Philadelphia and to Atlanta and to Boston and, you know, places like that and come back the same day. I think with Led Zeppelin, I think we went to Pittsburgh or Cleveland or something like that. Pittsburgh, maybe. But with Elton John, we're going to Boston, and he got on the plane, and they had secretly brought Stevie Wonder on the plane earlier, and they hid him in one of the bedrooms. And Elton John got on, and he was hungover, and he just wanted to relax. He had only a half-hour flight to Boston. He had a show to do. And the publicist started telling him, as soon as the plane took off, that said, there's a plane company hired a piano player, and you have to just come back to the middle and see the piano player. And Elton was like, no, I don't. Leave me alone. I have to sleep. And he said, no, you have to just come and see this piano player. You know, it's the company hired him special just for you. And he's like, I don't care. I rented the plane. I don't have to do anything. You know, leave me alone. And he really was annoyed at being bothered. And the publicist would not let up and said, look, I'm not going to leave you alone until you come back and see this piano player, and then you can go to sleep. So he walks back a couple of feet back to the main part of the plane, and Stevie Wonder is playing Crocodile Rock on the built-in piano. So his mood changed immediately. He got in a much better mood really fast. And I took a picture of them smiling and happy together. And then I was done for the night, and I hit the bar.
let's finish up the interview with a question that I like to ask everyone, being as that you're such a music fan. What is the one song that you would like played at your funeral?
Oh, I've thought about that. It's again, I can't really make a one or even a top 10 list. I have like a cassette full, you know. There's an album.
It's going to be the longest funeral in history. It'll be like it should be a gig.
But I want something fun. You know, at Joe Strummer's funeral, they played the Roger Miller song, You Can't Roller Skate in a Buffalo Herd. And I always thought that set a really good mood for the day.
Yeah.
It's a very silly song, but a fun song. So I think I'd like something like that. Like, I don't know, off the top of my head, I can't even think. You know, I was once got to write a top 10 list for a magazine, and it went to 25. Because I had one A and one B and one C.
You're terrible at editing.
Well, I'm pretty good at editing, but I can't cut things like that down. There's just so many songs, like Miles Davis, Sketches of Spain, or, you know, The Who live at Leeds, or The Clash live at Shea Stadium, or, you know, John and Yoko, Imagine album, or the rock and roll album from John Lennon. I have loads of favorites, you know.
Is there one song that you listen to on repeat? Have you got a song like that, or...
I did in the 70s when I was printing. I used to listen to Larry Coryell's Barefoot Boy on repeat, and also the Roy Buchanan albums. I used to put them on repeat.
Really? Why those songs?
Well, they're very spiritual and very meditative.
Okay.
Kind of like sometimes I'd have Miles Davis' Sketches of Spain on repeat because it's just that kind of music that you can just listen to all day and night.
Yeah.
And every time you hear it, it sounds different, and it takes your mind to different places. So it's basically that reason, because you just, it's always different when you hear it.
So what's up next for you, Bob? What can we expect from you soon?
Well, all my life people have been asking me to write a book. Instead, I have 15 books of pictures that are out in different formats in different countries. But this one's going to be a book of words. I will put together a biography of some of the stories of people I've met and places I've been and what it all means to me you know, what I've learned along the way, that kind of thing.
And when can we...
It's not going to be about f-stops or focal length or lenses. It's going to be about life.
Good.
You know, and how to experience life and enjoy life.
Yeah. And so when can we expect that?
In about a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time.
Yeah.
I've just sent out a proposal, actually. It took a while to get the proposal done, but I finally finished that, and it's out to a couple of agents, and we'll see who likes it, and see, hopefully, in the next year I can write the rest of the book.
And are you going to write it yourself, or are you going to get a journalist to do it, or a writer?
Well, I've worked with a number of different journalists, but it's never come out in my words. You know, it's never had my voice. And people tend to put their fantasy of what they think my life is like. And that's not what my book is going to be. My book is going to be mine. Even the books I have written and forewords and introductions and things I make, if I do an interview, I tend to do it to get the gist of it. But then I rewrite it completely and it ends up being all my words.
Okay. So who's your publisher for the book?
Well, that's what we're looking for now. That's why it's out at agents trying to find that. But I've just started. I mean, literally, I sent it to two agents 2 weeks ago and gave it to another one this morning. So we'll see how that works. It's the beginning of that project, but that's my main focus. That and the archiving and organizing everything.
Yeah.
But the main next project is a biography.
Oh, I can't wait to read that one. It's going to be brilliant.
Level, you know.
Yeah. Perfect. Brilliant. Thank you, Bob. It's been lovely chatting to you.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Now, if you love the show, then make sure you subscribe and tell your mates about it as well. And if you have any suggestions on who you think I should get on next time, then please let me know. I want to hear from you. Get in touch on Twitter and Instagram at Kylie Olson.
Music and Me is produced by The Podcast Works and OneSum Media.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.